To start off, I do have no relationships to disclose. So as Kim said, I work for an organization called Genetic Alliance. We're 25 years old. Actually, today is our 25th anniversary. And thank you. And we started out as the Alliance for Genetic Support Groups, which was an umbrella organization for disease support groups and foundations. But as genetics has expanded, we have as well. And we now work on a broad range of topics from public health to translational research, and also working with a network of over 10,000 organizations, disease-specific, community-based, hospitals, industry, government, you name it. So today I'm talking about JEDI, which is a project that is funded by the Office of Public Health Genomics at the CDC, or was funded by them. And it's called JEDI, Genetics for Early Disease Detection and Intervention. And essentially the basic idea behind it is looking at what does screening look like for this in this country around genetic conditions, and should it be expanded, in what ways should it be expanded beyond traditional screening that exists, like newborn screening. To kind of start this off, this project has been going on for, I think, about almost 2 years now, and we are very close to finishing a white paper. We're just kind of finalizing the future directions, which I'll talk a little bit about. But way back when, we started a long process of collecting information on opinions on what was out there, existing screening, and kind of what kind of the big question, are there conditions that are ready for expanded screening now being 2 years ago? So what we did to start out, though, is this is a very broad topic area and one that people have very strong opinions in opposite directions based upon things like evidence, based upon things like condition, burden of condition, et cetera. So we held salons, which were no agenda salons except to talk about this topic and get out some of the kind of ingrained ideas that people had. And we held four of them, one in Washington, D.C., one in Ann Arbor, Michigan, one in Salt Lake City, Utah, and one in Atlanta, Georgia. And we really tried to push people outside the boundaries of existing infrastructure or existing programs to say what could exist if we were to develop new systems, new programs. In addition, we conducted 21 stakeholder interviews that were a mix of public health, clinical, and consumer focus. These were, just to give you a snapshot of the questions that we asked, which genetic conditions are ready for widespread screening, are there any major gaps in evidence and information that need more examination, if you were to develop an early disease detection campaign, what would you do, which conditions, and are there any other things that the working group should focus on? This is very early on, and we got a lot of responses, which you'll see shortly. This is just a word cloud based upon the things that the transcripts from those interviews. You can see people talked a lot about systems, a lot about data and information. But, you know, very interesting things around kind of money and cost coming in here, around privacy, certainly around family, which you'll hear a lot about in terms of screening, which is maybe not the first thing that comes to mind when you're talking about traditional public health screening. So the big questions on what else the working group should focus on, though, were who should be screened, what type of testing should be done, when should that testing be conducted, where should that screening take place, a basic question on why is this even important, based upon current evidence, but quantifying that as well, the need to quantify it. There hasn't been a lot of work done on broad screening programs or expansion of screening programs, and then also the big question of how we connect the family. So one of the major things that we heard, though, is in terms of evidence, a lot of people felt like there weren't other conditions that were truly ready, that truly had the right evidence, both around the screening itself and the impact of screening. So what we felt would be more appropriate at this stage was that there really needed to be a baseline, a foundation laid for people looking at this question and the conversation going forward for expansion of programs. So we actually picked four exemplar conditions that people felt there was some evidence, but also really displayed some of the challenges inherent in expanding screening programs beyond newborn screening. And the four conditions that we chose were congenital hearing impairment, so looking at post-hearing screening from newborn screening, looking at Duchenne muscular dystrophy, familial hypercholesterolemia, and Lynch syndrome. And I'll talk a little bit more about each of these. So congenital hearing impairment affects 1 to 3 in every 1,000 newborns. It can be the first manifestation of the syndrome. And the important thing about this is newborn screening is part of the hospital-based EDDI programs, EDDI for early hearing detection and intervention programs. And interestingly enough, from the research that we did and the data that's out there, half of newborns, it's recorded that, or half of the newborns did not have a recorded confirmation of passing initial screen. Half of the newborns who did not pass the initial screen did not receive confirmatory testing. So more of them may have received that, but this is what, in terms of what has been documented, that many of them did not. Why is early disease detection important? That failure of the test is really a red flag for many genetic conditions, and treatment and follow-up with those conditions, those specific genetic conditions, may be very different than with a traditional individual or very personalized. In addition, early access to therapies and services, and we're talking about many of these individuals going through a very long and extended diagnostic odyssey. Why is this exemplar? We're talking about an example of multiplex testing already in practice. Something I'll talk a little bit more about is expansion of existing infrastructure being very important for expanding screening programs. It intersects with universal newborn screening. There's questions, really hard questions, about priority setting and essentially where money is going within existing systems. And it requires a process for choosing conditions within an already existing subset. Duchenne muscular dystrophy, most common muscular dystrophy in children, affecting mostly males. Common early signs include motor delays, trouble walking, running, muscle weakness. There's no cure, but there are therapies that improve outcomes. And the average diagnosis is age 5 and has not changed in 20 years. Again, diagnostic odyssey is very important here. And also this question of allowing parents time to prepare for a child with progressive disability, which is a benefit that might not be viewed for many types of screening as an important enough benefit in a medical context. So the question is, the reason why this is a particularly important condition to include as an exemplar condition are what benefits are important to parents, and therefore what benefits are important to the system. Really looking at piloting screening at different life stage is very important for this exemplar, and also just the fact that there's currently no cure but clear benefits to early diagnosis. Familial hypercholesterolemia, an autosomal dominant condition, characterized by abnormally high LDL levels. It's the most common inherited cause of premature congenital heart disease among individuals of European descent, and the clinical diagnosis is based upon family history, clinical characteristics, and lipid concentrations. Early detection is important because there is treatment with statins, and certainly identifying family members at risk. And then why as an exemplar condition? Really because it's a good example of cascade screening being identifying someone that has, in this case, maybe a heart attack or a history of high cholesterol, and then using that individual as the base case to identify family members who are at risk. So this idea of cascading beyond the initial tested individual. And certainly prevention potential here. And finally, Lynch syndrome. Looking at colorectal cancer, the third leading cause of cancer death in men and women. 2% of colorectal cancer cases are Lynch syndrome. This is another autosomal dominant condition, and it's characterized by earlier age of onset, multiple polyps, poorly differentiated tumors, and increased risk of endometrial, ovarian, and stomach cancers. Early detection is important because certainly prevention and screening for colorectal cancer, and that screening impacting surveillance. Again, we're talking about cascade screening. This is a great example of that. And we're talking about screening benefits of asymptomatic family members, which is obviously a very important thing, but also a very difficult thing to implement, especially for issues like if individuals aren't regularly seeing a primary care physician, how do you reach out to them? Or how do you get them to come in for screening when they're healthy individuals? So the white paper itself, which we're hoping to release soon, has this structure. I'm not going to go into this in too much detail, but one of the things we have changed over the last year of working on this paper is that we switched from using the exemplar conditions as the structure of the paper itself to more of the implications for broad areas of screening. So life stage screening, screening at different life stage, what are the correct times to screen, and also what are the differences in benefit for screening for these conditions at different life stages. That's a very important question to ask because these benefits change over time. In addition, cascade screening, how do you implement things around cascade screening? The big question being contact and outreach to family members. What's the correct way to do that? Currently within our medical system, this is a huge challenge. Doctors don't see families anymore. So how do you reach out to those other individuals? And what are the ethical, legal, social issues inherent in that? Questions of electronic health record prompts. People certainly view, in many sectors, electronic health records as kind of the holy grail to solve all medical problems for screening and identification of red flags. While I think now, as we're starting to implement meaningful use, people are maybe seeing more of the challenges inherent in electronic health records, but there's still a huge opportunity here. For example, in Duchenne muscular dystrophy, if people are missing cognitive or developmental milestones, is there information that pops up on conditions that could be that need follow-up? And then are there follow-up testing recommendations? Similar for cascade screening. Are there recommendations for outreach to the family? Are there standardized forms that could be provided within the system? And then finally, integration into existing programs, campaigns, and guidelines. Very, very important for expanded screening. You cannot assume, though, that adding more conditions or adding new types of screening into existing systems will be free or cheap. Sometimes it might not even be cheaper than establishing an entirely new program, but there certainly are many instances where we can not recreate the wheel and reduce costs through shared infrastructure. Kim, do you know how much time I have left? Oh, 2 minutes. Okay, great. And I'm going through this relatively quickly. There's a lot of content in this paper, but we will release the paper as well. And I'm around for questions, and I can go through any of this in more detail. So other issues for consideration, coordination between public health and clinical medicine. I think this is increasingly a topic, but the challenge never goes away. In the United States, we do have kind of siloed public health and clinical medicine systems. That is not the case in every country. How do we bridge that gap? And certainly, I think a lot of people view genetics and genomics as a place to start. It is an information-based science. This idea of electronic health records and genetic information serving as one underpinning of kind of identification of individuals at risk is a very attractive idea. So how do we kind of create this bridge with informatics between public health and clinical medicine for, starting in this case with genetic conditions and screening for genetic conditions? Certainly, benefits and harms, asking ourselves what are the criteria for expansion, which conditions should we start with? There does have to be some sort of order. for which systems, which conditions are the first priority. One of the things we looked at was existing criteria by the Secretary's Advisory Committee for Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children for newborn screening conditions, EGAP, which looks at genetic testing, and the USPSTF, U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, looking at their guidelines for, you know, adding new screening for conditions. And we decided that some of the major areas that need to be looked at for expanding to life stage and cascade screening would be ELSI issues, certainly, existing public health systems and programs, kind of the economics that go along with this, both cost and value, individual choice being very important, certainly in newborn screening, for instance, it is a newborn being screened, so the parents are involved. When you're talking about different life stage adolescent or adult screening, how does an individual choice play a part? And certainly then, how does that play a part in informed consent? And then certainly the family implications of things like cascade screening. Also the area of balance of benefits and harms, including both the validity and utility of the test, and the level of evidence around improved outcomes. And finally, the burden of disease, meaning prevalence and mortality and morbidity. And then finally, future directions, and this is the part of the paper that we are actually finalizing right now. What's the right specificity of recommendations to make? But without a doubt, this needs more focus. And it needs more focus from kind of national standard-setting bodies, but also on the kind of state and regional level to say what are the actual implementation challenges. What would implementation look like? What would the cost look like? And so we can go into this kind of expanded screening with our eyes open. Because, you know, creating national guidelines around screening is one thing, but the practical implications of creating a system that involves both public health systems and clinical care will be very challenging. Also, involving multiple stakeholders and, you know, providing opportunities for multiple stakeholder involvement, especially parents, clinicians, and public health workers. You know, what are the benefits? What are the challenges inherent in this screening, but also this really is a kind of a new world around cascade screening, and how do we create lasting outreach structures and infrastructure for working with families, and how could this benefit not just screening programs, but our medical care system in general. And then also looking at opportunities for public comment from the many stakeholders that would be impacted by this. So I think with that, I'll stop. There's plenty of areas, I think, where there's a lot more detail. Do we have time for a question?
Let's do one or two questions.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you get any sense from the discussions, one of the problems with hearing screening has been kind of decentralized follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And did you get any feeling from the discussions about whether people are thinking of this as something that you would have more centralized follow-up or decentralized?
Right. So with any, especially since there's an existing program, I think the idea was to, I mean, there are multiple different ideas. One was to kind of embed follow-up more into, we always, for every one of these conditions we heard of the answer is electronic health records, more into an automated follow-up with the primary care physician or within the process of their care team. We also heard more centralized. So we don't have an answer. In fact, you'll find we don't have a lot of answers in this paper. What we do try and do, though, is lay out the challenges, which haven't been really quantified and or kind of consolidated in one place. So I think I've heard both. One of the things we did here is there needs to be an economic analysis of decentralized versus centralized approaches, because there isn't a lot of information available. Sure. Okay, go ahead.
You talked about four different
you know, to see this, but I know in newborn screening there's a whole host of different, for different states and different hospitals. So I'm wondering kind of what you discovered about, or if you did at all, like before you narrowed in on those four, like what differences there are and the challenges associated.
Between newborn screening and...
with all the different diseases.
I'm like, where to start on that question? Newborn screening has been a kind of a long, slow progression, a kind of a grassroots build, until very recently when there has been more kind of focus on standards and growth for expansion of conditions. The Secretary's Advisory Committee has a whole process for kind of applying for to add conditions to the newborn screening panel, and a kind of a relatively clear kind of evidence threshold that's required. Recently, though, as kind of different types of screening are included, you know, pulse ox, looking at just not even just single gene disorders, but you know, you're not just talking about genetic testing. You're looking at metabolites. You're looking at hearing screening. The range of issues just exponentially expand. And once you're talking about not just with a newborn and a blood spot, they will be even greater. So the question is not, is there a way to consolidate all these conditions into one screening test? It's not possible, really. I mean, certainly looking at whole genome sequencing is an important issue, which we're hoping to do a follow-up paper on, what would be the implications of whole genome sequencing for this. But a lot of the tests that are done are not genetic tests. They're strictly speaking, the follow-up test might be. But so instead, I think we need to look at kind of categories around what life stage we're looking at, or we need to look at categories of effective systems for following up with family members and that type of infrastructure first, versus looking at one single condition. So we did try and choose conditions that had these kind of broad-based challenges rather than a condition. I mean, we did not choose these four conditions to say these are the next ones ready. We said if we have a system for following up with family members, that will help many, many conditions, and these are the types of things that we need to start looking at shared infrastructure around. And the disease advocates and the clinicians who work on that disease and the researchers will probably be the driving force for expansion to that condition, and you need that. You need that community to be the driver, but there are other infrastructure issues that we need to be talking about as a whole community right now.